Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I want to tell you about a new way to get the news each morning. Up first is the Morning News Podcast from NPR. Give us 10 minutes or so and you get a sense of the stories and big ideas of the day. Politics, science, the economy, and some culture, too. What you really need to know and why it matters. Start your day with Up First, weekday mornings by 6 o'clock Eastern Time on the NPR One app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, the Guardians of the Galaxy are back for a sequel, and we're there, too.
I'm gonna kill some guys!
Plus, from our recent show in Chicago with comedian W. Kamau Bell, a conversation about television, writing, race, and how things look to him these days.
White people, Trump is on you. It's your problem. It's your fault. Hashtag come get your boy.
And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in semi-historic Studio 45, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And we're very happy this week to have back in our fourth chair our friend from NPR Books, Petra Mayer. Hey, Petra.
Howdy, thanks for having me.
This weekend, we get a sequel to the very successful 2014 film Guardians of the Galaxy. That film represented what was then Marvel's strongest foray into comedic superhero movies, and it made a movie star out of Chris Pratt. Here again, the director is James Gunn, and again, the stars include Pratt as Peter Quill, Zoe Saldana as Gamora, Dave Bautista as Drax, and the voices of Vin Diesel as Baby Groot and Bradley Cooper as a raccoon. New faces include Kurt Russell as Peter Quill's father, Ego, and Pom Klementieff as Ego's initially mysterious companion. And we also see a good deal more of Karen Gillan as Gamora's sister, Nebula. The film brings Peter into contact with his own history. It puts the gang in new peril. And it does reimagine Groot as that little baby tree instead of the great big old tree he used to be, even though he still only says, "I am Groot." So, Glenn, well, remind me, how did you feel about the first Guardians?
I liked it. It a lot. It was fun.
How did you feel about this one?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. It was fun. we saw this in a press screening, which was a mix of press and civilians. And I watched as people came out of the theater, huddled into their little clots that they get into. And there was a lot of shrugging and a lot of voices going up. A lot of people turned into Larry David going, yeah, it was good. It was good. Yeah. And that's the way I feel. This thing delivers on its promise. The promise is, did you like Guardians of the Galaxy? Here's more of that. It makes some attempts to deepen characterizations and deepen relationships, but it is, the word I kept coming back to is clever. Everything about this film is clever. That's not a dig, that is praise, because it knows how many space battles we've seen and does something visually interesting with each and every one, including having the guts to cut away and do a character beat while something big and explodey is happening in the background. So, I mean, I have some quibbles, but generally, I loved it.
How about you, Petra?
I also loved it, but I sort of also hated myself for loving it because I want to concur with Glenn. This is a rare thing. We should enjoy it. The whole overarching theme of the movie for me, I mean, there were a couple, but it was, did you like this thing in the original movie? Here it is, turned up to 11 and repeated three times. Like, I could feel the movie pressing my buttons as I sat in the theater, and yet I was laughing like a hyena and also crying because I cry at commercials, and I always cry at Guardians of the Galaxy, apparently. So, I mean, yeah, like, how many times do we need to see Drax having no social skills? How many credits jokes do there have to be? You know, how many balletic space battles set to 70s cheese classics? I mean, yes, I love them. Give me more.
Right.
And it did. It did.
Right. But it would be hard to argue that this movie was terribly surprising.
Nope.
Particularly if you've seen the first one. How about you, Thompson?
Yeah, I feel basically the same way. I think that I enjoyed it enormously. I found it completely engrossing. I never thought about anything else while I was watching it. I also felt it suffered from a very common affliction in movies like this, which is sequel bloat. It's about 15 minutes longer, and you kind of feel that. Everything is more. There's more action. There's more drama. There's more effects. There's more sentimentality. Mm-hmm. I really felt the bloat of the sentimentality a couple times in this movie. But at the same time, I really enjoyed it. And I have to say, like, one thing that I found a little unusual about this movie, when you talk about the overarching themes of it, I thought this movie really leaned into the idea of redemption and forgiveness in really interesting ways. You have a lot of, like, bad guys who have a good side that comes into play. And like Glenn said, I thought that it's more of the same, but it's still clever. It's still interesting. And there are a couple of visual set pieces that are just absolutely stunning and kind of worth the price of admission. I enjoyed it enormously.
Yeah, I enjoyed it enormously, too. And I feel like one of the problems with reviewing a sequel, particularly a sequel to a movie that you liked, is that a lot of what you liked about it, right, this really interesting deployment of Pratt, who prior to Guardians, you hadn't seen in quite this confident, funny dude. You'd seen more of like a schlubby, funny dude on Parks and Rec, for example. Yeah. A lot of the stuff that you like about this movie, you've already talked about with the first movie. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you have to kind of come to the table in this situation and say, posit that a lot of the things that I really dug about the first movie, I still really dug. Right. I think Baby Groot is still a very funny, silly. They still have a tremendous amount of fun with that character. I mean, it's cute. What
do
you
think? The credit sequence was amazing with Baby Groot dancing. It was also, I thought, a really great use of 3D, because we saw it in 3D, to have Baby Groot dancing around in the foreground while all this chaos is happening behind
him. Yeah, I thought that was fun, too. I don't want it to be mistaken for a sense that I didn't enjoy it when I say it winds up putting you in a position of saying, here are the nits I would pick, right? So here are the nits I would pick.
I have some nits, too, yeah.
I do think they used Pratt in this movie more for sentiment. He carried less of the comedy in this movie than he did the first one. Now, part of that is good, right? I think they spread the comedy around a little bit more. There's funny stuff even from the interactions between Zoe Saldana and Karen Gillan, which there is some humor in some of those exchanges. There is a lot of Dave Bautista, I felt, more than in the first one, if I'm not. I felt like they leaned more heavily on that.
Yep.
Yeah, totally.
Even some of the interaction between Pratt and Kurt Russell spreads around kind of who's doing what in the movie. I wanted a little more Peter Quill wisecracking than I got out of this movie. He gets sort of bogged down in a story where he's separated from most of the team. And that I regretted, because him interacting with the other people in that team was one of my favorite things about the first movie.
This, I find, is a really standard flaw in a lot of sequels like this. The first movie, you have the origin story, and it is the coming together of a group. The second movie, so often, is the splintering and one hopes ultimate reassembly of that same group.
It's like when Jim went to Stanford on The Office.
I was going to say, like, and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs too, man. Right. But no, the you wind up with a lot of the movie spent with these people not able to bounce off of each other. Mm-hmm. So it spends a lot of time exploring sub-relationships, some of which are more interesting than others.
Mm-hmm. Right. But that's important, because that's how you define these characters. You bring them into sharper relief by pairing them off and having them react against each other, which is why I was grateful for Gamora and Nebula getting more time together. Didn't necessarily lead to something that was revelatory, but I really liked Karen Gillan's performance, particularly as Nebula, which we saw almost none of in the first movie. And she's an incredibly great actress.
Yeah.
And I've only seen her be charming on Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen her be badass in this way. And this was fun.
And it's so hard to act through the amount of makeup that she has. Mm-hmm. Her look is so extreme. It's even more extreme than Zoe Saldana with the fully green getup. Hers, I feel, is even harder to act through, but she's very effective. I agree with you. How about you, Petra?
Yeah, she does a lot of it in body language. I sort of noticed how stiffly she carried herself compared to Gamora. Mm-hmm. But what I was going to say about Peter Quill in this is that I thought he carried less of the comedy and more of the emotional arc, because another theme that I thought was really heavily leaned on in the movie was the idea of family. The number of times somebody said, we're not friends, we're family. Yeah. Peter Quill and his daddy issues, Gamora and Nebula learning how to be sisters. Yeah, I would have liked some more snark from Peter Quill, but I also kind of love the fact that the big husky action hero is carrying the schmoopy emotional arc, and it's not the romance, which I kind of, well, we can talk about that later, but I mean, that's a thing with the first Guardians movie, and more so with this one, is that they're so melodramatic, they're so soapy, and I just love it. Like, please put more luscious emotional arcs in my big summer shoot-em-ups. Like, that's what I want.
Yeah.
You mentioned something that's different about this particular summer shoot-em-up. And I think one thing that I really don't want to overlook is the music. This movie leans very, very heavily, as did the first one, on its soundtrack. It feels like a little bit like an infomercial for the soundtrack, which it very much is. You can apparently buy a Doritos bag with a headphone jack where you can plug it in and listen to the soundtrack.
America rock!
So, I'm running right out to the grocery store after we tape this.
But if you listen to the tone of the songs, and part of the kind of gag of it is that there are these like late 70s, early 80s soft rock songs. They're the songs that Peter Quill's mom liked. And so they wind up, in effect, scoring a lot of like action set pieces. And so if you think about the soundtracks to other superhero movies, I jump immediately to there's a Spider-Man theme called Hero by Chad Kroeger from Nickelback. And like, it's punishing, it's leaden. And this music has a lightness to it that I think keeps this movie lighter on its feet than it might otherwise be with how much is going on and how much portent is in it.
Yeah, and I do think that after a while, the juxtaposition of the kind of funny, upbeat 70s song with the battle begins to lose some of its newness compared to what it was like in the first movie.
Right, because the bones of this thing are familiar. It's not a dig. The bones of this thing are there is some mass destruction on a human scale, which the first film didn't really have.
Yeah.
I felt it was unnecessary.
There is a countdown timer. Not spoiling anything, but there's a countdown timer.
Is.
There still is a movie with a countdown timer. Mm-hmm. And there's a villain reveal that, you know what it is? You mentioned, Stephen, that it's a lot of sequels have this issue. It felt like the new Star Trek films, right? Mm-hmm. So we get the origin story, the coming together. We dispense with a con stuff. And then finally, like in last year's Star Trek Beyond, we have basically an extended episode. This felt like an extended episode of the Guardians of the Galaxy show.
Right.
With people going apart and coming back together. Yeah. It just feels like this thing has got some momentum now.
Yeah. This is going to be one of my favorite segues in the world. That reminds me of something that I want to say about Ibsen.
Wow.
So... recently in New York, I saw the play A Doll's House Part 2. You know, it's a contemporary play that attempts to say, you know, 15 years after the events of A Doll's House, which is an Ibsen play in which a woman winds up leaving her family. And it was written in the late 19th century. So it's, you know, long before you had your Mary Tyler Moores, right? You had this, at the time, quite shocking ending of A Doll's House. This idea of, like, what on earth would possess you to pick up this story, you know, 100 and some years after it was originally written and try to think about writing another chapter to it, right? Because spoiler alert, it was written by someone else, right? And what it got me thinking about was how there is a distance that you can get from an original work where when you are adding to the story, and this would be true, I mean, obviously, if it's going to be this long, it's not going to be the same creator. But even if it is the same creator, there's a distance that you can get where you can legitimately say, I just want to think about what might have come next. And that is one kind of sequel. And there are actually films that are sequels that have been like that, that have been made many years later. But when you have one like this, the problem that you have is it just more of the first movie? It's not like, in retrospect, what can we say about where this story might have gone next, right? You're just making another one. And it's not that that can't be good. It's just that it's different. And we've talked some about this before, but it's different when it's just a continuation of something that was very successful, even if it's been long planned, right? It doesn't feel the same as the, like, for example, the Star Wars stuff, where there was always this grander story that it always seemed to be telling. I think those elements, perhaps, I mean, they may have all been in place before they made the first Guardians. I don't know how much of this they had decided to do, but I do think it's a little bit more challenging to make a sequel when it's so close on the heels of the last one that you don't have that distance, which is one of the things that makes Guardians of the Galaxy different from Ibsen.
I gotta say, you beat me because I had a reference in my notes to that Peter Greenaway film, The Pillow Book, but man, you beat me. That makes me think of sort of also fanfic, which is a response to original
text.
But it also makes me think of where Guardians of the Galaxy sits in relation to something like Star Trek. It is not a property. It was an obscure property that, you know, the original screenwriter, Nicole Perlman, pulled out of a selection of things she was offered at a Marvel screenwriting workshop, I think.
And she's not involved in this
one. No, she's not involved in this one. But Guardians of the Galaxy doesn't have the same kind of history, canon, and fan involvement that you have to work with a property like Star Trek, which I think sort of feeds into what you're talking about in terms of the sequel being just more of the same. Because there's decades less canon around it that you can work with.
I think at the same time, it's also constantly trying to build on just the sheer number of characters involved. It's running into some of the Avengers bloat where you're trying to juggle what was once, you know, maybe five or six and is now like 10 or 15 different characters in a way where you naturally wind up giving some of them more to do than other people. I was fascinated with how fascinated this film was with the character of Yondu, played by Michael Rooker. That movie, I think, expects its audience to be a lot more emotionally invested in that character than certainly I was.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I am invested in Kraglin, who is played by Sean Gunn from Gilmore Girls, is kind of a space Kirk. I call him space Kirk.
Is he James Gunn's brother?
Yes.
He is. He is also the physical model for Rocket Raccoon on set. This leads us nicely into a little bit of service journalism we can do. I've been asked, do I need to have seen the first one recently or even at all? And I would say no. I purposely did not go back and watch it again. I know Petra and Steven did, but I decided I wanted to come into it as absolutely, because these films slide off your cerebellum as soon as you see them.
That's why I did it.
Yeah. And I wanted to see. So most people are not going to be grinds like these two and go back. They're just going to say, oh, it's a summer movie. Let me go see the summer movie. And apart from the fact that Gamora has a sister, that's it. There's really nothing that comes back from the first film. There's stuff around the edges. But in terms of...
And where there is, they'll tell you.
Where there is, they will tell you repeatedly.
Yeah. So so before we go, I do feel like we should cover kind of the main new character.
Right. Mantis, who maybe Glenn can elaborate on Mantis's presence in the comics. I, for one, thought her portrayal in the movie was kind of the one big clunker for me. You know, hate to use the word problematic, but problematic.
Yeah.
She plays into a lot of subservient Asian woman tropes. Yeah. And just personally for me as a nerd and consumer of a lot of fantasy, I am so, so intensely sick of the like beautiful, innocent female empath.
Yeah.
Like women's be feeling things apparently, and that's where our power comes from.
Right. And the character has antenna and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the actress, while she's French,
does not have antennas.
I was going to say is half Korean. So that sort of goes into what Petra is saying. I get that. Well, I know that a lot of you are going to go right out this weekend and see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Tell us what you think. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, a conversation with W. Kamau Bell.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/happyhour.
Welcome back. Our next guest is a stand-up comic and the host of CNN's United Shades of America. He also hosts the podcasts Politically Reactive and Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period. He has campaigned tirelessly to save Doc McStuffins. His book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, will be released on May 2nd, and we are so, so glad that he could join us tonight. Chicago, help us welcome W. Kamau Bell. Hey.
Hey.
So you can adjust that so it's comfy for
no,
you.
No, this is perfect.
Yeah, we were trying to figure out who was approximately the same height as you, and the answer was not any of us.
No.
But so my buddy Sam Sanders did want me to ask you, and it's in the book.
Yeah.
About the W. Kamau and the Walter and all that,
yes,
which you talk about in the book.
Did I? I wrote it a long time ago.
You did talk about it in the book.
That's good. I was writing very quickly.
So Sam wanted to know about that journey.
I was a little kid. I knew once I realized you couldn't actually be Spider-Man or Batman, I realized I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. And I thought the name, I always went by Kamau. That's my middle name. And I thought the name Kamau Bell didn't sound exciting enough. And then I saw A. Whitney Brown on Saturday Night Live. And I was like, you can do that? You can. So my whole name is Walter Kamau Bell. And I couldn't go by Walter Bell because that's the name of an insurance salesman. Which is literally what my dad did. He was an insurance salesman. So it was like, come to the stage with the fiery rhetoric, Walter Bell. It just doesn't, it doesn't work. So W. Kamau Bell. And so I made people say it at open mics for years. And then even now people go, do I still have to? Yes, you have to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're a podcast guy.
I am a podcast guy.
We're podcast people. Talk to me about the podcasts that you host. How did you get into the Denzel Washington business?
There was an opening in the Denzel Washington business because there was no podcast that was called Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period.
Yeah.
And there was two openings, so me and my friend, comedian Kevin Avery, who used to write for Last Week Tonight,
yes,
took that opening and started a podcast. People thought it was a joke, but the title is a joke, but the feeling is 100% real.
Yeah.
It's not a game. It's not a game at all.
Yeah, and you talked in the book about how it's kind of grown out of not only being about the amazingness of Denzel Washington, but also being about representation in Hollywood and a lot of other things that obviously are important.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, when you talk about Denzel Washington, because he's in a lot of movies, and in movies he plays like a dad or a husband or, you know, there's always black actors around him, and so you automatically start talking about them. And then the podcast happened sort of simultaneously as like Oscar So White happens by April Rain on Twitter. So that hashtag Oscar So White goes around. So we automatically start talking about it. We were also big fans. Me and Kevin were, Kevin's a big Matt Damon fan. He would start a Matt Damon podcast if he could, still, weirdly. But the podcast happened at the same time. HBO brought back Project Greenlight.
Yeah.
And there was the Matt Damon moment where he says, you know, representation is not what happens behind the screen. It happens on screen. It's not about behind the camera.
And Effie.
So we started talking about that. And then the woman, Effie Brown, who he said that to, who went, whoo, whoa. We started talking about her. And then she said that me tweeting about that moment helped her, like, in the press. And
I said,
so I'm doing the Lord's work.
Yeah, I could have watched. I could have watched a whole season of just the Effie show. I wanted her to just go have meetings.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I wanted to watch from that whole season, really.
Yeah, I still haven't met her, but I just feel like there's a lot of wisdom Effie Brown has.
Can we talk about the fact that Denzel Washington did not get to kiss Julia Roberts in the Pelican Brief, even though he kisses her in the book?
That's true, and I feel like I could bring some of the Denzels up here to talk about this. We've talked about this a lot.
Yeah.
Denzel apparently chose not to.
Yeah.
Denzel, I think we have to remember this was the 90s, and I think there was a thing where if you're going to break the racial kiss barrier that Sidney Poitier broke back in the 60s in a mirror, I think he takes it pretty seriously. And at that point, I don't think kissing Julia Roberts would have been a good look for him.
As Why is that?
Racism.
No. You meant from his perspective, it wouldn't be.
I can't speak for his perspective. And I don't want to speak for his perspective. I think that there's probably a calculation about, like,
right,
for everybody who's like, woo, some people are like, oh, I don't know, I'll see that.
Gotcha.
Make America great again.
So I want to also talk to you about the CNN show, which I watched the entire first season of, and it was so good. And I talked about it on our show, actually. I think the thing that people talked about the most was that you met some Klan members.
Yeah, that's the number one
thing.
That
seems to be the top headline.
If I'm in an airport and somebody stops me and they go, they know who I am, and they don't think I'm Questlove, then it's automatically... Yeah.
You get that? You get a lot of Questlove?
I literally got somebody thinking I was Questlove at a party that Questlove was holding and he was at. I got... Yeah, somebody's like, thank you. And I was like, oh, come on, you. But yeah, so no, the Klan, yeah, brother, you did that Klan thing. That's how black people say it. Brother, you did that Klan thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you also did a lot of really other interesting stuff in that season. You did a prison show.
Yeah, I went to San Quentin Prison and talked to lifers. That was my favorite episode of season one, was going to San Quentin, because that was the one episode that actually turned me around and changed me, because I thought I was going to go through some sort of scared straight program at San Quentin, and was really scared to go into us. It's a legendary prison. Like, you know, any place where Johnny Cash recorded an album is not a place I want to hang out, you know?
Yeah.
But it was like they were all super, like, thoughtful and had really, and, you know, San Quentin is the California's best prison for rehabilitation, but they don't release people. So there's a lot of them, I only talked to men. The men there were all very thoughtful. I didn't talk to anybody who was like, I didn't do it. But I talked to a lot of people who were like, I feel like I've been in here for too long for what I did. Mm-hmm. And you would hear the crimes and be like, yeah, I can agree with you on that. And they all are developing job skills and life skills. And yet America as a whole doesn't, we like to put people in jail. We don't like to release people from jail because we think that makes us look soft. When if you go to like other countries, I think Norway, it's like, it's all about like, we are putting you through here so that you can become a valuable member of society again.
What changed the most about your perspective from doing that episode? What did you expect versus what you got?
I mean, I think the thing that I was very aware of in that episode was that I'd seen a lot of like prison porn shows.
Yeah.
Where it's like all about you sort of watch going, ooh, they're so mean and crazy. Like you get off on the thrill of them being locked away. And so I was very aware that I didn't want to make that show, and I didn't really know if that was possible because I'd never been into a prison before. And it was from the moment I walked in, and you see this in the episode, the deputy warden's talking, he's like, how do you feel? I was like, well, and we're like walking through the yard, and he's like, I was like, well, it feels kind of like a neighborhood that I'm unfamiliar with, and I feel, and then some guy goes, love your comedy, bro. And I was like, oh, it's great, it's great. And literally that was the moment I was like, oh, this is going to be okay.
Yeah.
So like, oh, they're very smart in here.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just the moment, like, there was not a moment. There are parts of San Quentin where, like, you know, Death Row was in San Quentin, so we didn't get to go there. They had no interest in showing us that, although we asked a lot. There's also parts of San Quentin where it is that sort of, like, scared straight prison where it's, like, the scary inmates. But the majority of inmates in America's prison system are people who are like, I did a thing, I shouldn't have done it, but I think I'm ready to go home. And
so
a lot of people who've, like, gotten college degrees. I mean, I was talking to people about college degrees. I don't have a college degree, you know. So these are people who actually have skills and have things to add back to society. But we have to change our idea about what prison is supposed to be in this country. It takes all of us, not just politicians. We have to go, it's about letting people out. It's about rehabilitating people.
I feel like most of the work that you do now is pretty deeply burrowed into what you think is important. It feels a little bit reductive to me to say it's political, because that makes it sound like it's about kind of the competition of politics.
Yeah.
It's more, it's current events, it's deeply...
It's political movements. I mean, I call myself socio-political because it's about society. So it's rarely about like the people in the offices.
Right.
Like on the podcast, Politically Reactive, we have with Hari Kondabolu, me and Hari have, there's not, we talk about not, I don't want just a congressman on. Like they're like, would you like to talk to, I was like, do they have something to say?
Yeah.
I don't want to have like, the, you know, people are like, you should get Kellyanne. No, I would never want to talk to, I don't want to talk to anybody named Kellyanne now just in case it's her. You know what I'm saying? I want to have a conversation with somebody. I'm not just trying to be yammered at, you know.
What are you trying to get out of those conversations? What do you hope will happen when you go into a conversation with somebody on the show?
I mean, all I really can hope for is one, that they go, he was nicer than I expected him to be. That's how my parents taught me. Just because people expect that I'm going to be like some sort of ha-ha, zany comedian.
Yeah.
And two, that they walk away going, there's different types of conversations. One where you agree on a lot of things, but you're looking for nuance. What do I not see in this? So I can sit down with somebody and talk about refugees and go, yeah, I'm for refugees, but not really know what that means. And you get nuance in the conversation. But with someone you disagree with, the most that you can hope for is they walk away going, huh, that's it.
Yeah.
But the thing is that huh can lead to like, eventually, I was totally wrong. But you can't expect, this is the thing that's happening right now in this country. I encourage people to have uncomfortable conversations and awkward conversations with people about Trump. If you disagree with Trump and you have people in your life who voted for Trump, and everybody does, especially every white person certainly does. I don't know anybody. That's because you don't talk to your family. That's why. That's because you stopped going home for Thanksgiving. But people expect that in one awkward conversation, they're going to be like, I tried to talk to my grandpa and it was bad. So we just don't, it's not one conversation. So I expect that you have to be able to have multiple conversations. And those of us who believe in change and whatever this thing is, the resistance, have to be ready to have many conversations and do many things. You can't expect to get it done in one conversation.
When you spend as much time as you do being the person who people come to and say, what should I do next? Tell me what to do. Let me process my feelings at you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get a lot of that.
How do you make sure that you can keep sort of doing that work without totally running out of...
One thing is, don't expect that I have the answer to everybody's question.
Yeah.
I think I'm very clear on, like, people are like, I just need to know what to do. So I'm like, I have no idea. Good luck to you. Here's a hug. I mean, and I'm also pretty good. It depends on... It's funny. A lot of it actually depends on the race of the person. With black people, when they're like, what should I do? It's like, well, we got to get up earlier. We got to work harder. We got to do all the work that our people before us have done and people out there are doing. All the work of the civil rights movement that we've been doing. We just have to do more of it. White people, it's like, okay, here we go. There's an organization called Showing Up for Racial Justice. It's called Surge, and it's an organization for, yep, see right there. Talk to those white people. And so white people right now are in this moment like, how do I stem the tide of the hate? How do I deal with all this race stuff and the racial division? And I feel like white people need to start talking to white people. So I encourage every white person to come up to me and is like, what do I do? Talk to a white person. White people, Trump is on you. It's your problem. It's your fault. Hashtag come get your boy.
So out of doing podcasts, doing television, mm-hmm. you got a lot going on. What made you decide I want to add writing a book to everything else?
Oh, Jesus. I come from a book family. I think like my mom is an author.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's how she put food on the table when I was in high school. She self-published her own books. Books called Famous Black Quotations that she did herself. She did not get published, and then later, like, Warner Books published them for her. But so I come up from a household where you walk into the house and it looks like a library. So books were always important things to me. They're always like these. They meant something, and they had power in them. You know, so it was always something that was like, people write books. But I knew that at some point when I was like starting to like get ideas, because every comedian, once you become a comedian with any sort of name, they're sort of like, would you like to write a book? And
right.
I was like, I have nothing to talk about. But over the last 5 or 6 years, I feel like I have more to talk about. And I feel like, you know, a lot of that has to do with becoming a parent. A lot of it has to do with the direction the country's been in. A lot has to do that with like the volatile nature of my career over the last 5 or 6 years. That it's just like, and I really enjoy writing, like I get asked to write like articles a lot. And it's just like, I enjoy the process. And the thing about writing a book is there's always a word count in everything. You know, like, you know, people ask you to write a thing. They're like, it's got to be 750 words. And I'm like, but I can write 750 words and not even know what the topic is.
Yeah.
So for me, the book is an opportunity to really take detours and go down into places and surprise myself because nobody's telling me to stop writing. So,
yeah.
So yeah, having said that, this is the last book I'll ever write. So
why is that?
It's limited edition. It was just really, really hard. And the thing you learn when you write a book, especially that has memoir in it, is that who am I to tell these stories? You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. some stories you tell, you're like, this is really, and then also then your wife reads it and goes, what were you talking about? That didn't happen that way. And so I tried to the book really own my perspective on things. While at the same time, I think it's really important right now because I work in, to talk about this, like the Trump thing is in the book because it happened right as I was writing it.
Right.
And the representation in Hollywood thing is huge for me. And talking about how I have seen that affect my work in show business negatively, and now I'm working to make sure it affects it in a positive way. As I talked about in the book, the first season of United Shades of America, a show about inclusion and diversity, I was the only person of color on the show.
Yeah.
Because I didn't hire the people. I was hired onto the show. And it was really hard to do a show about the Ku Klux Klan when you sort of want to turn to somebody and go, do you know what I'm going through? And they're like, nope. I mean, they know on some level, oh, yeah. you look sad, but they don't know, as a black person would, you're thinking about every dead black person who's been killed by the Klan. Yeah, that's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
Not so funny. But like, there's just the thing about like not having somebody to look to, and this is true if you're the only woman somewhere, it's that way. If you're the only openly gay person, that thing where you have to do more of the work if you're the only one of your kind around. So
yeah.
For me, it's really important, especially as I get older and talk to younger people who are coming to the show business. Like, you have to, one, be able to make your own gravy, and two, you have to fight for your vision, because otherwise it'll just get thinned out into a very not tasty soup.
All right. Well, that is I very much enjoyed that conversation, I'll tell you right now.
Yeah, I bet.
Lots of fun. And W. Kamau's book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, is available now. And his show on CNN that we talked about, The United Shades of America, is airing now in its new season. And when we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? So come right back.
We'd like to say a quick thank you and share a message from one of our sponsors, AT&T's Audience Network, and their new original series, Fearless with Tim Ferriss. Ferriss is an author, entrepreneur, and podcaster who spends his life asking questions and scouring the globe for answers. Now, he's sitting down with renowned performers to dissect strategies to succeed. Premieres May 30th on Audience. Watch Fearless with Tim Ferriss on DirecTV, UVerse, or stream on DirecTV Now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
A new addition to my household, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe for the Nintendo Switch.
Party at Stephen's.
Party at my house. Bought the kids a Nintendo Switch a little while back. This is one of the games they've made available for it. It is very, very, very similar to Mario Kart 8. They have made some subtle, but I think very important improvements. The one that is most germane to my interests is that they have added an option for smart steering, which allows you to play without constantly plummeting over the side of the road you're on, being plunged into the inky abyss below. I've seen several takes on the internet about this new feature. Many of them are, it's awful, here's how you turn it off. And the other one is, isn't this great for small children? Now, I'm here to tell you that this is particularly good for dumb old dad, who now gets to come in 11th instead of 12th.
There you go.
With much greater frequency. At one point, I actually Googled, like, God, is there this wave of fan appreciation for the fact that now parents can play with their kids without constantly plummeting over the side? I found a Google result. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe smart steering means father can play with... And I'm like, oh, see, that's my story. And then I click through the story, and the full headline is, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe's smart steering means father can play with his physically impaired daughter.
Oh.
Which is actually a very, very heartwarming and beautiful story. But I found that not enough attention was paid to people like me who can finally play this game. So we have been playing it much more than we have ever played video games together before. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe for the Nintendo Switch.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I just finished Jason Zinnemann's book, Letterman, The Last King of Late Night, which is a very smart book, and it's very clear, and it is convincing. He divides Letterman's tenure on Late Night, all incarnations, into discrete eras, makes a strong case for them, spends most of his time on the NBC years, which I think is also really smart, because that's obviously the part where he is at his best comedically, not at his best as a host. He was always pretty much a lousy talk show host, but and also his most power culturally. And it also specifically spends a lot of time on the role of Meryl Marco in that show, which is a crucial thing to do. And he does it. There will yet be a book that talks about Letterman's role on the culture. This is a book about Letterman's role in Late Night, but spends a lot of time on backstage squabbles, don't care about that. But a portrait emerges of a man who is racked with self-lacerating self-loathing. And it's a fascinating thing. The other thing, very quickly, the free comic book day, as you listen to this, is tomorrow, Saturday, May 6th. So go out, get some free comics, and read my post on Monkey See that gives you a list and also a mini reviews of each and every one of those damn books. I'm halfway through it. It's going to be fun.
It's great. We love it. Free comic book day. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
Lots of things, but particularly I've been reading a lot of books recently by female authors who are taking sort of established mythoses and turning them, reworking them. And so the book that's making me happy this week is Wintertide by Ruthanna Emrys. It's one of these books that kind of fell through the cracks. I didn't pay attention to it. I don't know why, because I'm dumb, but I picked it up about a month after it published and read it and went, oh my God, it's so good. She is running the Lovecraft Reread on Tor.com, and this book actually started as a short story on Tor.com. They run a lot of original fiction, and it was called The Litany of Earth. And basically, I love this book so much that I did an interview with her, which will be up on NPR Books by the time you hear this. And the thing that she said to me that stuck with me was that, you know, this story, which is about sort of, if you know the basics, it's about a creepy town in New England populated by creepy frog people who turn out to be monstrous, and they sacrifice humans to their elder gods under the sea, and it's all horrible, and they get wiped out in a government raid. And so what she told me was, and this is the quote, "I was shocked when the story started with a government raid that sends the frog monster people to concentration camps. It wasn't that Lovecraft himself could write this, as much as that for almost 80 years, people had read this story and sympathized with the protagonist who calls down the raid. My own sympathy was squarely with the frog monsters." So she takes one of the survivors of this raid 20 years later and sets her in San Francisco, where she's trying to make a life for herself and grappling with the idea that now the government has changed their views and wants to work with her. And so if you like Lovecraft, if you don't know anything about him, if you don't want to touch him with a 10-foot pole because he's a racist, sexist jerk, everybody, all of those people should read Wintertide, because it is a really lovely, compelling book that takes this mythos and just turns it inside out and builds an amazing lost world out of it. And I highly recommend it.
Thank you very much, Petra Mayer. So what is making me happy this week? You might know Chris Gethard as kind of originally a kind of garagey YouTube podcast kind of star who has kind of worked into more mainstream celebrity, I would say. Mm-hmm. He has a new special. It is coming to HBO on Saturday, this coming up Saturday, May 6th, as we tape this. It's called Career Suicide. And in the special, he talks about a variety of experiences, including profound depression and suicidal thoughts and dealing with his family and friends and work. And there is a very funny kind of backstage story about a comedian, another comedian who you will recognize by name. It is the kind of special that fits for me into the growing kind of category of people in comedy who have spoken openly about their issues in mental health. A lot of that has been brought to the forefront by the John Moe podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, which is currently between seasons, but has spoken to a number of people. Maria Bamford and Rob Delaney has talked about this in places, John Moe himself. And Gethard here is getting at a very difficult thing to do, which is to make a special. And it's not really a comedy special. It's more like a one-man show. Mm-hmm. And it is a special that is both very funny and very earnest and heartfelt and utterly unafraid of moments of strong and powerful sentiment. And I liked it very much. I was very moved by it. And speaking as somebody who has my own kind of depression and anxiety things, people who have been willing to talk about things like that have been really helpful to me and I think to a lot of other people. And so every time I see one like this that has something new to add, it's a very iterative field. Every yeah. time you see one of these conversations, they bring another angle to it. They bring additional pieces to that emerging puzzle. So Chris Gethard, Career Suicide, a special that is coming to HBO. Before we go, we have a couple more things that we want to talk about, both very, very good news.
Yeah.
Right? First of all, we want to encourage you to check out a show that we have sometimes talked about before.
Oh, yeah.
Which is Bullseye.
Yes.
Interview show hosted by Jesse Thorne, featuring a remarkable lineup of guests.
Yeah, remarkably.
Including just recently, Chris Gethard. Mm-hmm. And DJ Jazzy Jeff and George Saunders, all in the same podcast.
It's amazing.
That to me Beautiful. Is like peak Bullseye.
Yes.
Jesse talks to all kinds of interesting people. Talk about how much you love Bullseye.
Well, I love it because of the guests he gets, but also how he interviews those guests. Because what you can do is just go through the archives, find somebody you like, and you will find somebody you like. Because Jesse has that kind of sensibility. And just listen, because he will ask them questions that they have not been asked elsewhere. And mm-hmm. that is hugely important. All hosts should do that. Few hosts actually do. And you will get a conversation that feels not necessarily deeper, but realer, more human. And it puts you in touch with this person in a way you haven't been in touch with them before. That's the yep. idea.
Bullseye, available wherever you get your podcasts. We are fans.
All right. You can even hear episodes that you've hosted.
One's true. One episode hosted yeah. by me.
Hear an episode where I was interviewed.
That's right.
I think Holmesy, you and I were on that show at one point.
We were. We are all over that show.
I'm the only person here that hasn't been on Bullseye.
All
right.
Call me Jesse.
And our final piece of business today.
Yes.
Final, and I'm going to say best piece of news all day. We have a live show coming to New York City. Ooh. I love New York. You know I do.
Yep.
And we will be at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. It is happening on June 6th. We will be joined. Oh, gosh. Who's that lovely woman who's joined us for some of our live shows who we're going to have with us at the Bell House in Brooklyn?
Again? She's like an NPR host.
Audie Cornish. Oh, Audie Cornish is going to be with us at the Bell House in Brooklyn. It's going to be a great show. Tickets will be available at nprpresents.org. Now, you will remember the last time we did a show at the Bell House, it sold out in 10 seconds. Basically,
10 seconds.
The mad rush that we hope will happen this time will happen when tickets go on sale on Tuesday, May 9th, and that's at noon Eastern. Again, if you wait long, if you wait 11 seconds,
right,
you might not get one. NPRpresents.org is where you can find your tickets. Bell House in Brooklyn, June 6th, Audie Cornish, me, Stephen, Glenn. It's going to be so much fun. Big, big, big fun. And again, NPRpresents.org at noon on Tuesday, May 9th. All right. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Petra at Petramatic. That's PETRAMATIC. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music that you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.